owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Bravery, conspicuous gallantry in action, extraordinary heroism, unwavering devotion. These are some of the phrases used to describe a certain segment of our military members who are authorized to wear our nation's highest military honor. The Congressional Medal of Honor was established in 1861, and the 159 years since it was created, fewer than 3,600 persons have received the medal. The first person to receive the Medal of Honor was Private Jacob Parrott of the 33rd Ohio Infantry for an action during the Civil War. Interestingly, the first action for which the medal would be awarded took place several years earlier on February 13, 1861, when Army Assistant Surgeon Bernard Irwin volunteered to lead a rescue mission to save 60 men trapped by Apaches. The Medal of Honor had not been proposed at the time, and Irwin would not be presented with the medal until 30 years after the deed itself. Now, here on American Warrior Radio, we've had the pleasure of talking to movie stars and music legends, successful entrepreneurs, captains of industry, even a couple of NFL Hall of Famers. But I've got to tell you, the pinnacle for a show like this is to talk to one of the only 69 living recipients of this, our nation's highest military honor. Today, we're going to do just that and discuss a new initiative to establish one location where their stories can be told and properly honored. First up, he became the first living Medal of Honor recipient of the Iraq War for actions performed on November 10, 2004 in Fallujah, Staff Sergeant David Bellavia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Well, thank you. That's probably the greatest intro I've ever had in my life, and I would love to talk about my new project coming up with Tom Cruise and be that Hollywood icon that you know, does interviews. But it's really amazing to be, you know, for me as an infantryman, all of these Vietnam guys, it's like hanging out with Iron Man and Spider-Man. You just don't think that they're real human beings. I mean, Hershey Miyamura is one of the greatest Americans who's ever lived. Woody Williams, who had a flamethrower in his back in Iwo Jima. And I'm in a cocktail party with these guys, and I don't want to answer any questions. I want to ask these guys questions. I want to hang out with them and just hear their stories. It's a really surreal experience to be a recipient.
Now, are you joking about the Tom Cruise thing, David? Because it wouldn't surprise me, but...
No. I'm saying, wouldn't that be, usually...
Oh, okay. All right.
When
just
people,
checking.
Yeah, no, I'm saying, I'm not... I will take that intro. It's very kind, and I'm very humbled by it.
But, David, I'd like to start off with a description of that, because I know when I've seen, I watched your speech there when you received the award, and you appropriately give credit to all the other soldiers and the people who supported you. But, I mentioned Hall of Fame NFL guys. There's, when there's a last-minute winning play, there's coaches that design the play. There's a quarterback. There's even blockers on the way down. But there's one guy. I mean, there's a water boy even keeps a Gatorade cold. But there's one guy that carries the football. And in this case, that was you, David. I want you to listen to something real quick. There's lots of firsts in Medal of Honor, but yours may be the first to actually be captured on film.
You know, it was about... For David, it was about stepping up for his brothers around him, because he couldn't just send someone else in there if he wasn't ready to do it. So he was doing it for love. And I remember that night, the rest of the platoon had been pushed across the street and were taking cover in some other abandoned houses. And there, exposed to the fire from the rooftop, standing behind a Bradley fighting vehicle, was David, pacing like a caged tiger in the dark, muttering to himself. So I walked up and stood there with my arms crossed and waiting for him to finish pacing. And he looked at me and basically said, "Stuff it." And I said, "Stuff it." And it was at that moment he decided to go back in there for the love of his brothers. And I don't know, for one reason or another, I was foolish enough to go with him.
David, that's someone that you lovingly referred to as the Australian lunatic, Michael Ware, and he was with you that night.
Yeah, look, I've worked with a lot of embedded reporters. After the war, I went and embedded myself you get, you know, you get people that show up with Banana Republic pants, cargo pants on, and they want to play reporter, and then you have people that go there to really tell the truth and tell the story. Michael Ware, I've never ever worked with he's more soldier than he was, a reporter. I mean, he was in the fight getting shot at, covering, doing all the things that he was doing. And he decided that he was going to come. Now, again, it's so weird to you have a vision of what you went through, and then to see it, to hear it, and you think to yourself, you know, did I sound like that? Was I really having an existential moment? All of these things filtered out through so many different, you know, points of view. It just gives you, you know, I never in a million years thought that that day was anything that we would be talking about 15 years later. It was just, we did our job, we did our part, you know, and there was more fighting to do. But, you know, here we are.
David, if you don't mind, sir, I want you to walk us through that and just share, I mean, what you can keep in mind, it is family radio. I mean, I don't think you and Mr. Ware actually said stuff it, but that's okay. So you literally, in this case, you were, now the second Battle of Fallujah, these guys had 6 months to fortify. You're walking into a hornet's nest and you're supporting the Marines, and it was your job to clear this house. Your squad tried to go in, got pushed back, and just take it from there. Take it from that point where that pacing tiger just said stuff it.
Yeah, so basically, one of the things that we were, you know, I was older when I was in the military, so I joined after college. This happened on my 29th birthday. Most of these young guys were 18 to 20 years old, so we're in totally different phases of life. And one of the things that I was really super careful about was making sure that these guys not only were ready for the fight that they trained for, and they were professional, they dedicated their lives to this job. But at the same time, we want to make sure that they're psychologically ready. And one of the things that was really troubling to us was that the enemy was not only had our gear, but they were wearing our uniforms and had our equipment. And so, you know, we tell these young guys, you know, wear your helmet, it's going to save your life. Now we're going to show you how to destabilize that helmet, where to shoot in that helmet to make sure that the enemy, if they're wearing it, we can take them down too. And they question, you know, well, why can't they do that to our, you know, if you know this, how does the enemy not know this? So it was constantly this, are we engaging our own people, or are these the enemy wearing our uniforms? We punched in. We had a mission to get 8 to 10 bad guys. We blocked them off in a neighborhood and just were going building to building, door to door, house to house. And when we made a stop, one of my soldiers turned his ankle and we just took a little break, smoked some cigarettes, you know, relaxed, had, you know, got something to eat, maybe catch a few, you know, minutes of shut eye. And next thing we know, on the other side of this wall, are these guys waiting for us? They knew exactly where we were, and we walked into this house and there were belt-fed machine guns and they had set up Jersey barriers. You know, it was a house set up to blow up. And everything that was going through your head is, when does this house blow up? You know, are we going to be in it? Are we going to be outside of it? What do these guys want to do? We're not dictating anything anymore. It's on them. And I found myself on one side of the building and the guys were on the other side. And, you know, it's just a matter of time before this thing goes sideways. And so it was a matter of first breaking contact, getting out of there. And that was, of all the things that took, the only thing I really thought about for a very long time was stepping in a doorway and shooting a machine gun. And it just, it looks good on paper. There's a lot of things that go through in your head. But just knowing that those rounds are coming, you've got to shoot back. Do I want to sweep that machine gun? Do I want to go up and down? Do I want to try to throw a frag and then shoot? I was just trying to, you know, how does this work? How does this happen? And
David, I tell you what, if you don't mind, hold that thought, because we do have to take a break, and I want to pick up the story from when you really you crossed back into that perimeter or through that barrier again. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia. Now, you think every Medal of Honor medal has a story, and you think there'd be one place where all those stories can be told. We'll also be joined by Joe Daniels to talk about that when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with David Bellavia. He is a Medal of Honor recipient for his actions in Iraq. We're talking about the Second Battle of Fallujah, and if you know anything about military history, that was just that was a mess. And David, when we took the break, we just stopped before because I wanted you to get the full story. I know, because you're a radio host too, you have the ability to tell stories with words. Tell us, my senses I got when, so your squad had been pushed back out of that house. You knew this had to be taken care of. Nobody was going anywhere. You're still taking fire from the roof. And you were just filled with rage and resolve. And so you just grabbed a saw and decided to take care of business.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, when you ask for a bomb with a battle as sophisticated as Fallujah was, Marines, everyone shoulder to shoulder going to a city. Getting a bomb is like, getting a number at the DMV. I mean, you're waiting in line. And if you're number 14, there's 13 other people that need a bomb more than you. They get their bombs, then you get your bomb. And so waiting for a bomb was going to take hours. And it was just impossible that we were going to let these guys go. And all we had seen up to that point is a bunch of Islamic terrorists running around with American equipment. And we couldn't determine, did they get that by buying it? Did they steal it? Or did they kill a Marine, kill a soldier, and grab his rifle? Are we going to see, you know, the guys that we let go, are they going to, you know, is a folded flag going to be handed to an American family because we let these guys slip away? And we were losing our own. We lost our sergeant major, and we lost our company commander, and we lost our executive officer, and it was a personal loss to us. So in Iraq, if you had the ability to keep the enemy fixed, it wasn't just that they stopped shooting and they ran away. That's not a victory. A victory is when you stand over them and they're never going to harm or threaten or kill another American again. That's victory. And so it wasn't just enough that we had them pinned down. We had to make sure that we took them out. And every decision that was made was because 19-year-old, 20-year-old soldiers did their job and did exactly as they were told to do. I mean, we would tell a guy, take this corner, stay here, and that kid would be there for 4 hours waiting because he was told to stay there, and he takes down, you know, his targets. He takes down the opportunities that are in front of him. So everything that we were able to do was because everyone did their piece. And sometimes as a leader, you get to see things a little bit farther back and realize, you know, if I'm going to send four kids in there, you know, NCOs have got to go with them. Mm-hmm. This was a situation that if we sent too many men through the door and that building went off, we're going to lose more guys trying to bring back, you know, the folks that are injured. In a house fight, it's the OK Corral. It doesn't matter if you're SEAL Team 6 or, you know, you're Annie Oakley. It's the quickest to the draw. And if they know where you're coming from, you know, we like to throw frag grenades. And everyone thinks that if it all goes down, just throw a frag. It's the Middle East. There's no drywall. Everything is concrete. Everything is block. And you throw a grenade, all you've done is set off a giant smoke grenade that has no ventilation. It just, that smoke just sits there. And it literally blocks everything. You can't see anything. They can see you. They know where you're coming from. They set up the ambush, but you can't see where they are. So a frag actually makes your life that much more complicated. And sometimes you just got to go back to, you know, the beginning of gunpowder. And our smart bombs, our laser-guided bombs, sometimes it just takes us going eye-to-eye, man-to-man, and taking these boys down.
David, I've read an interview or I heard an interview where you said, you know, if I'd had time to think about it, I probably wouldn't have done it. And that's something I've heard from other Medal of Honor recipients like Woody. But so you're in this house. It's dark. You're clearing the house. But I got to ask you, sir, based on what I've read, I mean, what kind of steely-eyed machine gun man pauses for a smoke before finishing the job?
One who has no idea how many people are in the house. You know, that's really what it can, you know, you think to yourself, you know, you trust your eyes, what you can see, what you can hear. Your hearing is great until you engage, you know, gunfire in a closed off building, and then your hearing's gone and you're tired. And, you know, your head is just, your smoke is filling your eyes. The building's on fire. You can't trust anything. The only thing you can really trust is your sense of smell. And you can smell if a person's been living in a house. You could smell, you know, their body odor. You can smell, you know, everything. And it's almost, it devolves into the most animalistic way of you're smelling where people have slept and where people are. And when you see, you know, these guys were doing drugs. Most of the enemy fighting the American machine will do drugs. It doesn't make sense to, you know, you're not going to win. So that was a common thing that these guys did. But the problem with that is that you would shoot someone repeatedly and they would still come at you. So you don't know, is this the same guy? Is this a different guy? Is this his friend? He has a beard. He has a T-shirt on. But I thought I hit that guy, and this guy's not, you know, hit. So is that a different guy? Is that the same guy? You really don't know how many in real time. It's not like, you know, watching a baseball game, everyone keeps a scorecard at their seat. You know, you're just focusing on eliminating the threat as long as it's there. And if it turns out it's seven, it's seven. If it's two, it's two. But, you know, just keep shooting until no one's there to shoot back.
David, it's interesting in preparing for today's show and in my talk with Joe, you and Joe coming up here. It's interesting to me all the parallels I see when I talked to Woody Williams, who received the Medal of Honor in the Second World War. He too was confronted by a fanatical, suicidal enemy. And that's what you all were dealing with there in Fallujah as well, correct? Pretty much.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, it seems there's a lot more akin to the enemy in Afghanistan and Iraq. You really have to go back to the Imperial Japanese. You know, the Red Cross, medics, these things weren't respected by the Japanese at all. You know, there's no timeout for get our injured off the field. The folks that would set off an IED, we go to take care of our wounded, another one goes off. We've never seen that before. I mean, there's no Geneva Convention here. And so there are similarities, to what the enemy that we fight. And, you know, one of the things that's important about that is, you know, when you have a museum like the Medal of Honor Museum is going to eventually be, is one spot to see all this. When you look at American history and you look at the Civil War and the Boxer Rebellion, World War One, all these different Spanish-American War, really that is a part of our ethos as Americans. There is a warrior DNA that we're born into. And what men have done in 1862 and what men have done in 2013, really not a lot. Technology changes, but at the end of the day, we're fighting for our culture, we're fighting for our way of life, and we're fighting for each other.
David, that's a perfect transition. I'd like to add to the mix now Joe Daniels, who is the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum. Joe, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thanks for having me. And hey, David, how you doing?
I am great, Joe. Good to hear from you.
Joe, I don't know. We've got about 2 minutes before the next break, and there's something I want to – let me just plant the seed now, and we can follow up on it after the break. We've been using sports metaphors, it seems like, all day here on this show. You, prior to joining the National Medal of Honor Museum, you were the president of the National September 11th Memorial Museum. That's like two Super Bowls of history and remembrance.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason that I wanted to get involved in the Medal of Honor is that my experience through 9/11, both being at the towers on the day of 9/11 and then carrying that through to being lucky enough to help lead the effort to really stitch back together that wound that was in lower Manhattan and in our country, It really showed me the power that these places have to inspire and to transform America. And, you know, it's although it's a burden and it's hard, it's much more a privilege to be able to work with either 9/11 families in that case or with Medal of Honor recipients in this case. And it's really, really been a privilege of a lifetime.
Joe, you're in a very unique position. Have you noticed parallels when we talk about bravery and sacrifice on behalf of others? I'm guessing, you're seeing the same sort of story repeat itself in both memorials.
I mean, 100%. I mean, I can't say enough about that. I mean, just what David said, that warrior DNA that he was talking about is exactly the same kind of DNA that led, 343 FDNY guys and more than 400 first responders to rush to the site of these burning buildings and run into them to help, more than 20,000 people get out. And the way that these firefighters talk, it's the same kind of thing they're talking about. They were just doing their jobs. They want to make sure that we are telling the stories of the guys that didn't get out. And when I was lucky enough to see the actual confluence, and we had Medal of Honor recipients in some cases come to visit the 9/11 memorial, the bond that we saw between the NYPD and the FDNY and these Medal of Honor guys was just amazing. It was so authentic, and they're all part of that same ethos that David was talking about.
Joe, when we come back, I want to follow up on that thought. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, we're joined by Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia and also Joe Daniels, the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum. You'll find out more about this one permanent location where we can hear more about these legacies. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking about a new, relatively new initiative to build a national museum to honor the recipients of the Medal of Honor, the highest honor granted to our military members. We're joined by both Joe Daniels, the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum, as well as David Bellavia, who is a recipient of the Medal of Honor for his actions in Iraq. Joe, in looking at watching the remarks, David's remarks at his award ceremony, he was speaking a lot about his comrades and the other men who got him to the point where he was able to. In fact, he had some of his other squad members on the stage there, if I'm not mistaken. And he mentioned countless citizens who will never know them. Tell us about the impetus behind the initiative to have a national museum.
You know, I think it's those comments are just really, really powerful. And I remember very specifically in the aftermath of 9/11, we were always going to have a memorial in some fashion to honor the 2,977 people that were killed on 9/11. But the museum wasn't a foregone conclusion. And when we first approached the FDNY and the other first responders, their initial reaction was, we don't need a big museum to be sort of a vanity tribute to us. When we were able to explain that it's actually a museum about them, but fundamentally for the American public, this was an opportunity to share the stories not only of them, but those who they served alongside with in that case. And it just changed the level of enthusiasm. So when you think about our 244 plus year history as a nation, given that it's the highest award for valor in combat, I think it says something about our national priorities to say we as a country remember these individuals, and we know that if properly utilized and properly shared, their stories can inspire people in everyday civilian life to make the tough choices when they're faced with them. And I think that's in part why we need this museum. And having David, who's on our board of directors, and we have four other recipients on our board, having them be a part of this, we're going to get this done, and it's going to make the whole country proud. And we're just blessed to be a part of it and blessed to be underway.
Joe, I know you may not have accepted or expected a quiz today, but you're a professional, so let me do this. Looking on the interwebs, you never know what's accurate or not. The best I could come up with was 3,526 recipients and 69 living Medal of Honor recipients. Is that in the ballpark? Can you correct me?
That's definitely in the ballpark. I mean, it's really interesting, and one of the things that we're going to show in this museum is sort of the history of the medal itself, how in the Civil War era, a lot the Medal of Honor was really the primary, the single medal that was given out, and it wasn't until World War One where there started to be a hierarchy amongst medals, and it started to take more of the shape that it is today in terms of being at the very, very, very top. I was also really lucky just recently on 9/11, which, of course, is such a powerful day, to be able to meet our newest Medal of Honor recipient, Thomas Pat Payne, who is also from Iraq and was involved just in this incredible operation to free 70 hostages from being executed by ISIS. And you think about the history. We've got Medal of Honor recipients from the post-9/11 generation, Vietnam-era recipients are currently our biggest number of living recipients right now. There's only a couple left from World War II. But that's why, given the few that are left that are living, we do feel a sense of urgency to get this museum done and allow them and their families to see how much this country cares about what they've done for us. And it's certainly a motivating factor behind all the effort.
Well, we're lucky to have one of the experts himself right here joining us today. David, what is your thought as someone, because I'm always impressed with the amazing humility and the credit that you and your fellow recipients give to the other soldiers or Marines or airmen around you. What was your gut response, David, when you first learned about this museum?
Well, first of all, you know, we're trained to, you know, be honest. We have a core set of values that's ingrained into us on day one of basic training. So if we're being honest, we can't take credit for anything because we know the way the battle ended up, and we know how these things happen in combat. You know, rank in a firefight is ceremonial. You know, you're not going to just follow someone because they're the first sergeant. You follow leaders because they have distance direction. They know what's happening on the ground, and they're there with you absorbing those rounds. It's a beautiful experience. We talk about combat and the horror and the ghastliness of it, but really you see the essence of why we're alive. And today in America, we're a divided country, and people in their little partisan camps and tribes, now more than ever, they need to go to a building to see that African Americans and Hispanics and Catholics and Jews and Muslims, everyone who represented this flag in this country, did it for all of us, did it for one cause, one nation. And, you know, you look at Arizona and the heroes, their recipients, Fred Ferguson from Way City and Bruce Crandall, who's one of the biggest lunatics I've ever met in my life. That guy is the cool. I mean, he is an absolute legend. Leonard Wood, Fort Leonard Wood is an Arizona guy. I can't go to Tucson. I can't go to Tempe. I'm not going to be able to walk the ground that these heroes walked. If I can go to one place and literally have every single representative of what they did, why they did it, and who they did it for, that's the real message of the Medal of Honor Museum, is why this is worth it, why America is worth it. And these recipients that came before us said that, you know, loud and clear. Many of them lost their lives in doing it, but it was for this country and what we represent.
Joe, you know, it's interesting that David mentioned that. I saw Lieutenant Colonel Will Swenson, another Medal of Honor recipient, said, "This narrative is who we are as a nation, service, sacrifice, and compassion." And David touches on that. When you go back through the list of Medal of Honor recipients, there is I think there's only one woman who's been awarded it, Mary Walker. But we have Indian scouts who've received the Medal of Honor. We have people of all colors and creeds and who all are standing, well, for whom this medal all reflects the same values that we as a nation should celebrate. And when the museum is open, Joe, that's one thing I love about this, was a critical aspect of this is going to be education of future generations, correct?
I mean, absolutely. And I think, you know, David said it so well, this notion, what makes America special, what makes America the shining city on the hill, is this idea that people from so many different backgrounds, you know, they can still retain that part of the culture that they want to, but there is something that ties us together in this American experiment. And so it is all of these different backgrounds, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic class, they're all together. And I think that this medal represents it, and this the actions that they undertook, the fact that, you know, you can be buddies with someone who is from a completely different geography than you, and you're there potentially ready to give your life. That's a powerful message to send during this time where our country does feel divided. And I remember after 9/11, you know, people would say to me, you know, isn't it a shame that we were so united? And then, you know, 6 months later, we're arguing and fighting again. And I would say, you know, this is America. We're supposed to argue. We're supposed to debate. But what the 9/11 Museum can do, and what the Medal of Honor Museum will do, is show that when the times require, we can come together with just limitless compassion and limitless effort in defense of really the American dream. So I think that this is an important national treasure that we're undertaking. We're also, by the way, undertaking to build the first ever National Medal of Honor monument in Washington, D.C. And the amount of support we've seen from both sides of the aisle, just in the last couple weeks, we had a bipartisan introduction of our monument bill. Senator Cornyn from the Republican side with Senator Tim Kaine from the Democratic side. It shows you that while there may not be enough of these things, the things that do tie us together, they need to be celebrated and reinforced. And I think people will see that in this museum and the monument.
And Joe, I want to talk more about that after we come back from the break. And David, in the meantime, I don't want you to neglect our Sacramento listeners. So I know you're in an airport somewhere, but get on the internet and look up a Medal of Honor recipient from Sacramento for us, if you don't mind. I'm just kidding.
I will find a Sacramento. I'm sure they're out there. Okay. They represent all walks of life.
Stick around, folks. More with Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia and Joe Daniels, who is the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the Medal of Honor and specifically a new museum to honor the legacy and tell the stories of those who've received that honor. David Bellavia is a Medal of Honor recipient himself. He's joining us on the phone. And also Joe Daniels, who is the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum. Joe, back to you. Before the break, you were just alluding to the fact there's the museum itself, which is going to be in Arlington, Texas. But there's also the National Medal of Honor Monument Act to place a monument in D.C. as well, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, our hypothesis is that we build the museum in America's heartland and build this monument in our nation's capital. And those two prongs really give us the best chance to impact this country around the values of the medal. And I think that, you know, people talk about sometimes needing to put a face on the evil things that happen in this world, but equally as important is I think we need to humanize the incredible things that happen around the world and in this country, people in their civilian lives, you know, whether it's during a school shooting and where a assistant coach will lay down his life to try to save students in Parkland, Florida, or much smaller acts where people are doing something that is tough, but is the right thing to do. And having this monument where people can visit in our nation's capital and they see all the other, you know, great American memorials, and then having this center right in the heartland of the country to learn about the stories and really have our educational hub, I think we're going to make a real impact on the country, and we're certainly working towards that.
Joe, our listeners are a very engaged group, and they like to help, so let me get directly to it. When we're talking, how much money do you need? What's the goal to build the museum itself?
So the goal to build the museum is about $185 million, and I'll just say that after, you know, helping lead the creation of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, when people at this stage in the project, so a few years out before we open, you know, giving $5, $10, whatever they can give, signing up for our newsletter at mohmuseum.org. When we open this museum, every living recipient, every living president, and the entire eyes of the country are going to be on this opening, and to feel that, you know, you gave something or your family gave something early on is a special point of pride to feel a part of creating a national treasure. So I would encourage people to get involved, follow our progress, go to mohmuseum.org and learn some of these stories and become a part of it.
Now, that's something else they can do as well, as maybe contact their elected representatives about the Medal of Honor Monument Act. A lot of people don't know this, that those actually just authorize you as the foundation to move forward, but the federal government's not going to pay for this monument. You still have to raise the money to get it built as well.
Yeah, I mean, our general philosophy, I think, is that the bulk of this money should come from the American people, that there's something that reflects its importance when you do a fundraising campaign, much like the refurbishment of the Statue of Liberty, where, you know, you've got the bake sales and the Girl Scout groups. And also, of course, we need major donors to provide, you know, big sources of funding. We may come back at some point and say, you know, 80% of the money has come from the American public and we're looking for government support for a small portion. But generally, you know, this is something that means a lot to so many. And I just want to say that the museum, although it is the Medal of Honor Museum, in the DNA of the museum, it will really be honoring the service of those that have given back. So any veteran, when they walk in that museum, anybody, for example, on the front lines of this COVID crisis, these healthcare workers that are putting themselves at risk, they're going to feel that it's their home too. It's really about honoring service above self, and it's really going to do that for everyone wherever that service manifests.
David, one thing I've noticed is very often recipients like yourself in your second mission, if I can call it that, are out there working to educate people and to provide leadership and inspiration. I want to get your take on something that happened recently. It's just one of those things that make me shake my head. A German auction house recently had an auction, was selling a Medal of Honor awarded for action during the Spanish-American War. Now, this is illegal in the U.S., but apparently not in Germany. David, why should we all take offense at that?
Well, not that, you know, this is something that, first of all, you have the story behind the Medal of Honor. Then you have a family's legacy. And one of the things that the Medal of Honor Museum is done is not only bring attention to this story and protect that legacy, but also give families an opportunity to say, you know, put this, you know, in a center where other people can come, children can learn and educate. You know, for someone to just trade that as if it's a pair of boots or it's an MRE case is quite insulting. But more importantly, that whole family is robbed of that opportunity. If you found out that someone from the Spanish-American War had received the Medal of Honor, I mean, you've got a swagger to you now. I mean, this is a part of your heritage, and this is something you want to put on a mantle and say, my great-great-grandfather, you know, gave the ultimate sacrifice for my country. And it's insulting, but the way that the auction house did it was pretty cavalier and obnoxious. Not that we need any more reasons to look down on the Germans, but the Germans don't see it the same way. Understand, our American valor is something we've always looked at and said, you know, America hasn't always been perfect. America's made mistakes, but we're transparent about our errors, and we always put the warriors above the policy. And Germany doesn't have that shared heritage. There's a lot of moments in German history where they want to forget about it. So maybe if you found a Nazi plate, you want to sell it for money. We don't have that legacy. And so when we look at our valor and the men and women who have done so much, we are proud of it. It represents who we are. And thank God for Joe and the museum to bring attention to this. But more importantly, put other people on notice. If you try to sell an MOH, if you try to move it in an auction, you're going to have to deal with a lot more than just two people that read that article in a newspaper. The museum has motivated people to stand guard. They're guardians of this award now, and it's a beautiful thing.
And Joe, the foundation itself actually took a public stance against this, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, we've worked really closely with Senator Cruz, who also feels the same way that we do and that David does. I mean, these medals not only represent a very personal history to the individuals and to their families, but they're they really embody this incredible and important national opportunity to inspire others. And they are just sacred to our nation. So, you know, when these medals, they get sold overseas, it really is a offense to the nation. And also, hopefully, what we're saying is we want to encourage people. And of course, we want, you know, donations to this museum as far as these sacred relics. But in most importantly is that we want to have these medals be really enjoyed and accessed and understood by as many people as possible. Because I can tell you, and I was lucky enough to see a medal that was awarded to Charles Davis, who was one of the few medals that are awarded in the battlefield at Guadalcanal. And just looking at that medal and seeing the, you know, some of the erosion that the sea salt would have done to it over the years, I mean, it embodies our young history as a nation, and it's so important to protect, and it shows how much we value valor and those that put others above self. So this is something, and with David's leadership on our board, that we are really serious about, and like he said, we're going to help be the guardians of these sacred legacies.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more. Please visit mohmuseum.org. Gentlemen, I'm out of time. I'm going to let David make the close, because despite the fact that he insulted the Germans and he didn't get the Bueller part, apparently, of my last name, you can hear David on WBN Mornings in Buffalo. David, 30 seconds, your close.
I want to say thank you to Sacramento for giving us Edward Carter Jr., who received the Medal of Honor in 1997 for President Clinton, posthumously in World War II. The man was an absolute stud, and that's the great part, is that they set the bar so high, these men and women who came before us, and every generation matches that and goes above it, and that's why this military is so special. We're volunteers, and we're willing to be there for the rest of our citizens, and that Medal of Honor represents every drop of blood shed to keep this country free.
David, thank you for what you did. Joe, thank you for what you continue to do. And David, of course, as well. Ladies and gentlemen, again, visit mohmuseum.org. Share this podcast with your friends so they can learn as well. You can find this and over 300 other stories at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're everywhere. If you like what you hear, please share with your friends. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.